Good evening, listeners. This is Julian Fleischer, your host for this edition of the Micro Musical Theater Show. I am talking today with writers of The New Peggy, a musical I assume you've just listened to and enjoyed tremendously. Am I correct?
Yes.
Yes.
I hope so.
Jay, introduce yourself.
What do you mean?
Say hi. I'm Jay.
Hi, I'm Jay.
What did you do on this musical?
I wrote the music and co-wrote the lyrics with Drew.
And who are you sitting next to there?
This is my collaborator, Drew Larimore.
We'll settle this. Book writer
and co-lyricist
of The New Peggy.
Is this the
only project you guys have written together
so far?
How's it going?
Good.
It's good. We're still talking.
Yeah,
that is a good sign. Did you have trouble sort of melding your minds over this project, or was it a natural and easy fit?
It was surprisingly natural, I thought, actually, because it's such a weird character and such a specific show that I wasn't sure. But Jay really jumped on the Titanic with me as we sank the ship, and it was really, really amazing.
You're going dark already.
Sorry. I told you I would.
You want to lighten it up, keep it light. Not the Titanic.
Yeah, 1 minute in and we're sinking.
Tell me, you generated this project, did you not, Drew?
Well, this was from a short play that I wrote, a monologue that was a part of a collection of other monologues.
That you also wrote.
Okay,
good. So just talk me through quickly, like so you wrote a monologue inspired by, I suppose, real events in your life.
It was a collection of monologues about women on the verge of insanity. So this was sort of the showpiece of them. And this, The New Peggy was actually initially, it was inspired from a job I had right out of college, and it was like my first job, and it was at a really sad company where people were really mean. It was out in LA, and there was a secretary that had been with a company boss for a long time, years and years, and he was basically dying, ran the business out of his home in a bed. And he would call and yell and demean, and people would throw things at each other. It was very sort of old Hollywood.
Goodness gracious, what was the profession?
I can't really say without being, I'm just wanting to.
Was it film?
I don't know. Maybe. It was a company. It was a big company, and it was really no one famous. I'm not talking about anybody famous right now.
And well, then why can't you tell me who they were?
No, I mean, I know they're all dead now, but
now you have to tell us.
No, can I just finish the story?
This is the first I'm hearing about any of this, by the way, so I'm learning a lot today.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wait, time out. You're just hearing this?
About this? Yeah.
Well, about this specific instance, which actually I did not know that this is where this project came from until I really had to think about it. And it was kind of a dark night of the soul, and it came into fruition. Wait, let me go back to the story. So it was a really dysfunctional, scary place to be 21 and have your first job, and throwing things at each other, and people were really mean. And this guy would call, and he was sort of like a much more severe, nasty boss from like 9 to 5, like that boss that they ultimately poison.
The great Dabney Coleman, if I remember
correctly.
That's
his name, yeah.
That was the actor's name. Right.
And he called in one day to the secretary that had been with him. He was like 80, you know, for a million years. And he called and yelled and screamed. And it was just real degrading. And I was sitting right next to her. And then she turned to me, and she had tears in her eyes. And she said, "He's like a father to me."
Ooh.
I will never forget that moment and how weird and bizarre and sad and funny it was. And I don't know if I knew it at the time, because I wrote Peggy like, you know, years later, but that is where Peggy came from. And when I think about the show, that is the moment I return to.
Well, it's interesting because the scene you describe does sort of resemble the one in the musical,
right,
in many ways. And I found myself really interested in the tone of this musical. It's hard to pin down the tone, and the scene you described sort of helps explain that.
Right.
In other words, what's going on is you have an adult acting like a child.
Probably a little bit more than that. There is an adult that is, you know, if you don't run your life, something else will. And I think Peggy is a real specter in that way.
She's childlike, which I would distinguish from childish.
Yeah.
I think childlike is really spot on, because there's a freshness or an innocence in her eyes. She doesn't really know what she's doing is wrong. I always try
to find... She also talks to utensils.
But right, but interesting.
We all do.
Well, there was one point where we were working on this, and Drew was like, you know, I talked to my espresso machine today. He's like, guys, we made it through the week. And I was like, oh.
Wait, this is made up. Did I really say that to you?
You really said that to me. But I was thinking about that because the other day I was talking to my Amazon Alexa, as we all do. And I was
Well, that's changed this whole
It's changed it because I was
landscape.
She wouldn't turn on the light, and I was getting very upset with her. I was like, Alexa, turn on the light. And she's like, I don't recognize that. And
she
I
says,
found myself
I
having
am
a
not
conversation
one of your fans.
With a machine. But when it works, it's like something else turns on that you've named. It's put me in the world of the show in a weird way.
That's interesting.
I do talk to machines now, I guess.
Yeah. But we also know there's something fundamentally different between your Alexa and his cappuccino machine.
Wow. Way to draw that line.
I mean,
or
I think
Eugene
it's
and Rita.
Yeah.
But. Yeah. Well, I think that we all have objects, whether it's a scarf or whether it's a this or that, that we all personify. But, you know, and clearly Peggy takes it a step further.
But I also think it's like the angel and devil, like the old trope of theater, like there's one on the shoulder, like one on the other shoulder. And that's kind of this demented version of that.
Right, right.
But he's so positive. And I think Eugene and her, like Peggy needs to.
Well, remind me, Eugene's a stapler?
The stapler.
Right.
Eugene's a stapler and Rita's a manila envelope.
Peggy interacts with these objects in a way that's really fully blown and in a way that suggests a kind of a person on the spectrum, really. I mean, I haven't overheard your conversations with your espresso machine, but how long do they really last?
This espresso machine's been retired, by the way. So
did it talk back? No, I mean, she's not insane. What she is very broadly drawn. She's a broad comic figure.
Yeah.
Who gets darker.
Well, it gets darker because the reality gets more.
But the notion of an adult acting as this person does on your musical is comic. It's not real.
Right.
And now how do you get on board with this? Do you get approached by...
I do.
Drew.
Cirilla Bear, who had done the original monologue, I guess at a festival, who I'd worked with in Adding Machine, the musical.
Oh, that's right. You worked on Adding Machine?
I did.
You MD'd that show,
too? I did.
You're so young. When did you...
Thank you.
How old were you when you MD'd that show?
25?
Wow. That's young. I wish to God I had seen that show, because I understand it was... spectacular.
So she, I guess Drew, I didn't know
well,
what to
she's
do
a deep
with the monologue.
Inspiration of mine. So, and I've written for her a lot. And
tell me her name again.
Cirilla Bear.
Bear.
And tell my listeners who that is.
So she's a great actress that was in Adding Machine and a bunch of other projects. And she helped originate and innovate this role. And I had been out of musicals for a while. And then I'd said, you know, with the encouragement of others that this should be a musical. And she said, oh, I know the perfect composer. So she linked us and was Peggy for a number of years and helped us develop it.
Right. Tell me why she thought you were the perfect composer.
Jay can live in both worlds. I mean, you know, there is a very sort of sad, reflective world of Peggy. I think we hear that in If It Wasn't For Me, the opening number. And she also lives in the fantastical. She lives in the murderous. She lives in a bunch of different realms, as we all do. I think on the day-to-day, and Jay accesses that musically in a way that, I mean, you know, I just never expected.
I read his original monologue, and then I wrote If It Wasn't For Me, which is the...
And tell me, this is a classic opening number.
He didn't have me to quietly clean up his spills. If he didn't have me to make sure he gets fed. If he didn't have me to tell him when to take his pills. If he didn't have me, he'd probably be dead. If he didn't have me, who'd make his coffee light and sweet? If he didn't have me to rub his smelly feet. If he didn't have me, his life would be so incomplete. Time's not...
That was If It Wasn't For Me.
Yes.
Sung by...
Anne Harada.
Making her thesis statement, which I note is not written in the... subjunctive, which I think is where it belongs. If it weren't for me. Do you think about that? Do you think about grammar, guys?
Yeah, well, Peggy has her own weird language.
Also, like, that's correct.
Not,
I think we need to phone in a English professor right now.
Well, you use the subjunctive in situations where it's contrary to fact. So she's, in fact, she's thinking about what would happen if the situation right. were not as it is, which is why you invoke the subjunctive. It's fine. It's completely fine. Nobody uses the subjunctive anymore. That's like, I don't know if you noticed on Twitter, it says, you know, who to follow. It really should be whom.
Well, that's whom. Preposition, and that's important.
I just felt that right? Peggy would say if it wasn't. That just
yeah.
It sings better.
It does. And that's right answer. I think that's really the answer right there. From
if it weren't for me, that's too hard. There's too many consonants.
If it weren't for me. And wasn't.
If it wasn't for me.
Yeah, no, it scans much more beautifully. Thank you for giving me the right answer. Because I think in the world of songwriting, all kinds of poetic license is taken in order to make something sing. I got to interview Sheldon Harnick last year. You know, he talked about how he would just shave away at syllables if he had to, until it came off the tongue the way it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the proof is in the pudding. I mean, you know, his songs just jump out of your mouth.
Right.
In a way that seems totally natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Peggy has a lot of things to say.
I'll say, my God, that woman worked hard. How long did it take to record this?
We didn't have very much time, unfortunately, but she had done it a couple times before in concerts and readings, so...
She's 3 days, I think.
Wow, she's really fabulous.
She's a pro. We love her.
Yeah.
But yeah, that song is, I mean, that motor, that bum, bum, ba, da, ba, it's familiar, but it's also just a little bit off, which is why Peggy, if we're going to like Peggy, we have to enjoy her in this opening number. So we kind of go on with a ride for the rest of the evening.
And I think that you know, not only are we sort of harnessing in an archetype that we know of, like, women like that that work in, or anyone like that that works in an office that's very micromanaging and controlling, and, you know, this place would not live if it wasn't for me. But also, I think that the interspersed with dialogue and the phone call that she's on, the number accomplishes what it's meant to, which is to really, like, we understand. I'm not sure that we totally get who she is until... how weird she is until the stapler and the manila envelope appear. Like, I think that turns the musical into a different sort of but more bizarre direction. But I think we get a taste of it in this number.
Right. I think the thing about Peggy is that it's so fantastical, but yet you feel like you still know this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's a bit disturbing.
Sure.
And you're really, like, oh, I actually know relate someone to this. Like this.
Yeah,
I shouldn't, but I do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of thrilling, but sad. And it's one of those, I don't know.
I think it's eerie. Yeah, I think it's eerie. Yeah.
Well, you certainly do get a taste of someone who is a host of contradictions. Anybody sophisticated enough to do everything that she says she's doing in that office to keep things in order and under control, who is also that incredibly naive to the point of seeming like developmentally challenged. You know, you have a contradictory character, which is great. I mean, human beings are contradictory, but it is a lot to sort of to digest right away. Like, she's so high functioning in one respect and so completely daft in another. And that's certainly an interesting and, I would agree, bizarre, you know, kind of character to follow. It's interesting.
Yeah, or if she thinks she's good at these, like, is she actually good at these?
Right. I mean, that's the thing that Jay and I talked a lot about in this opening number is how good is she at her job? You know, I mean, certainly her boss doesn't think she's that great. Is he just sort of insatiable, or, you know, is she completely incompetent and he just feels sorry for her? Or, you know, sort of what is that relationship she has to work? And I'm not even sure we know really by the end of the show.
I think that's cool, to be very honest with you. I'm personally a fan of musicals that don't make the mistake that most musicals make, which is to tell you everything in the first 10 minutes, who they are, what they want, where they are, what's going to change, and what's going to stand in their way, and what they might probably get by the end, which I think is one of the reasons a lot of people have problems with musicals. You know, they don't really want to be told all that right away.
Right. Well, and you have no idea... the scope of her insanity until
the
shit really hits the fan, you know. Yeah.
Let's talk about the audience. I'm curious, the audience for this piece, who is that? Who do you see? Where, I mean, give me your fantasy scenario of this piece. Where is it? Who's seeing it?
I think the audience for this is a committed and excited off-Broadway devoted clan that appreciates quirky, bizarre, irreverent musicals in the vein of Avenue Q and Silence the Musical and that sort of following.
I'm curious. I don't disagree with what you just said, but I'd like to talk for a minute about why we all know the difference between off-Broadway and Broadway. Like, why we know this isn't probably a Broadway piece, but more of an off-Broadway. Can you tell me a little bit about that, what you think about that difference?
Oh, I'm asking you, Jay. A commercial thing right now. I mean, if you look at most of the Broadway things running, they're all based on a film or, well, right now, mostly a film.
Yeah.
I think they're all not the W word, weird, you know? I mean, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a weird Broadway show on right now that...
No.
Maybe SpongeBob.
No. I mean, not...
But that's based on a hyper-successful franchise.
Exactly. I think it'd be more effective feeling like you're in that office.
In that office.
Them.
Yeah. Right. And because anyone that's ever heard this or seen a reading that we've done of it, they've said it's not a world that they've seen before. I mean, it's a identifiable... It's got some characteristics between the office culture and between Peggy sort of as an archetype, but not really. I mean, the sort of tenor of the show is not necessarily anything that we've seen before. And I think it requires intimacy. You'd be sacrificing a lot if it were on a bigger scale.
Do you see these other two characters, the stapler and the envelope, in like full on Disney, like stapler drag, or are they just people? Have you thought about that?
I think we've
could go either way.
We can go. Oh, we haven't really seen it physicalized yet, but my last vision of it, it was like you're just kind of seeing people, and then we understand that, you know, at the end of the number you just see a stapler on the desk, and that's Eugene
in a pin spot,
right?
I mean, they
but at first we did like conceive of puppets like Avenue Q, like
and
puppets
worked with puppeteers.
Oh really?
On in earlier drafts, and I don't know why we've gone away from that. It just seems like in our later conversations and readings and concerts of this, it's not been puppets, but in the beginning, yes.
I think it makes them real for me.
Yeah,
that and sad.
I don't care as long as they pop out of the desk drawer like they're physical object.
Oh, I see. So you would? It's cool if they're just people, but they have to kind of emerge from their place.
And
their
in
spaces,
like sad office sort of constricting blouses or, you know, suspenders or
sad
whatever
office.
It is.
Right. Something that will suggest what they are.
Yeah. They're almost like people we've worked in cubicles with, you know,
sure.
that just happen to be inanimate objects.
You guys are fun.
Yeah. No, but like
we're going downtown.
But that's why my approach.
This is a comedy.
It's always, I mean, it's like when you're an actor, you have to always find the positive choices, right? You're not going to.
Yeah, you don't want to play the darkness.
Right,
darkness
and Peggy is an optimist. And
yeah,
you know.
And they are too. They really believe that she's going to get something out of it, that she wouldn't go back to work every day. So like that's why musically when she goes to these different places.
Well, I do have a
so
question
fantastic.
About that. There, I do have a legitimate question about a plot situation in the show as I was listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't roll your eyes. Early on, her friends completely enable and support her absurd fantasy that mm-hmm. this phone call is going to be essentially a proposition of marriage, right? Mm-hmm. There's a whole number.
Closer, higher, thicker.
Yes.
Harry's going to ask me if I'll be his bride.
Play it, Gene.
Something that might affect, you know,
closer,
us. When I'm ready,
higher,
will you be ready too? Okay, bye.
We'll have it all this Monday, have it all this Monday, have it all this Monday. We'll have it all.
Yes. And then later in the show, when the truth is revealed, they're all like, come on, what did you think? You knew the whole time. If you had been paying attention, if you had opened your eyes, you would have known that this was not happening. So I'm curious how they get to play both sides of that.
To me, I always viewed them as, even though they are separate characters with their own characteristics, that they are functions of her mind. So I think as she lets go of the denial of what's actually happening, when she sees the evidence, she's actually realizing what's going on.
I see. So they're sort of stand-ins for her unconscious.
Yeah.
That's how I've always approached it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Great answer. I like it. I'm buying it. Hook, line, and sinker.
Denial can go real real deep sometimes.
Yeah, it's not just a river in Egypt.
But
don't tell me you never heard that line before.
I've never heard that line in my entire life.
No, come on.
True story.
Wow. Wow. We need to talk more.
I should.
I can Clearly. Reuse all my jokes on you.
Clearly.
It's going to be a terrific night.
That's what most guys say. Yeah.
Speaking of which, let's learn a little bit about your personal lives. You guys are creative partners, but not, I take it, partners in any other way?
No.
I was just asking, you know, you wouldn't be the first people to partner creatively and romantically. And I think it's a question that our audience has a right to know the answer to.
Interesting.
I mean, we don't even work in the same room.
You don't?
No.
Not a lot. No.
No, it's like telecommuting. You know, it's I think also when you're doing co-lyrics, you need space. I mean, I can't imagine doing that in the same room as there's a download that sort of needs to happen and a back and forth. And
in our particular case,
case. Yeah, sorry. I'm just speaking for us, but yeah,
you need space from each other.
I think it's just a scheduling thing. Like,
he lives in Queens. I live in Brooklyn. That's also part of it.
But long distance.
Good Lord.
Long distance relationship here.
Oceans separate you.
But also, I think with some of the, I think, I don't, maybe this is just particular to Peggy. I mean, if, you know, whatever we work on in the future, maybe it'll be different. But Peggy takes some download time. Writing this takes some download time. You know, it takes a little bit of space. It takes a long walk in the park. It takes a little bit of faith and time to sort of, I'm not sure if buy it is the right phrasal verb I want, but I don't know.
Phrasal verb?
Understand. And
but we don't work like typical, like I music direct a lot and see a lot of teams who work together. And because you're not from the musical world, we don't have any notion of how we should be writing songs. So I feel like you kind of wrote the play version.
Mm-hmm.
And even when we write scenes, you kind of write the play version. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of go away, find song within
inspiration.
It. And then some of his book actually becomes straight up lyric without me fussing with it. But
right.
Drew's not, I don't think, ever writing down, like, I'm going to write a song right now. He's never, I'm writing lyrics for you.
Yeah.
The show is weird in that way. In that,
well, I think
many of the songs are come out of, like, I just decide, hey, I'm going to set this monologue.
The title song did.
Yeah.
I think, because it was so show tunesy. But,
right.
But I, yes, a lot
but
of.
But I would take a monologue and then create a song out of that, and then we would both fuss with.
And yeah, there are speeches she has that Jay musicalizes, and or even with Harry too at the end.
This morning number.
Yeah, yeah. That bring me to tears. It's just so
playing
much
with
more
just
effective.
How music comes in.
Because until today, until this morning, I never understood what a morning could really have in store. Everything. You hear me, Peggy? Everything. And look, even if it never could, just the fact that I feel that way, that I look out and I see a big gulp so full of possibility I can't get the lid on, as dumb as it may be to feel that, well, shouldn't we always feel that? Isn't it better than feeling the opposite? I'm telling you, Peggy, I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I wasted so many mornings without that big gulp sitting on my shoulder, watching the sun come up. But hell, it's here now. And it's not going away. You hear me, Peggy? My big gulp of hope is not going away. And I hope it never goes away for you either. I hope you know what that's like.
Especially in a show where there's also monologues and speeches sort of throughout, which I think is a result of the fact that this came from a 14, 15 page monologue, but also there are moments that are better served by music, and Jay has a ability to take those words and
the use of underscore is something I think that's interesting to this show, because sometimes we just underscore the monologue and he sings a couple of phrases here and there, or she does, and it feels like it's long at the end of it, but it wasn't actually a song.
Yeah, it's not like a number.
It was just
some
underscore dialogue. So weaving in and out of that, I think, has been really fun and interesting.
Let's return to the subject of your your lives as people outside of this. Who, like, we know that you're not whatever, but where are you from?
I am from Detroit, Michigan, born and raised. And then I went to undergraduate at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. So lots of good music towns in my blood.
Yeah. Do you have like a Motown thing? Do you?
I love Motown. I like my dad was obsessed with the Beatles, and we would obsessively like only listen in the car to like oldies 104.3. So all of those oldies are in my blood. So that combined with...
Well, just be glad he wasn't obsessed with, like, I don't know, Flock of Seagulls, you know? At least it was the Beatles.
No, it was great. And, like, we watched musical theater things that came to town and stuff like that. So that combined with my classical training and then going to Nashville and learning about and, like, working with those kinds of musicians.
Like, you mean, like, country guys?
Well, I mean, all studio musicians down there are not just country, but they're just so amazing. They're some of the best musicians I've ever... just seen.
Right.
And then I came up here to write musicals.
You did. That was a decision. You're like, I'm going to write musicals.
Yes. Well, I learned about the grad writing program at NYU in my senior year at Vanderbilt. Decided to apply on a whim, got in, and decided that if I was going to do it, I was just going to do it now. And it was a good excuse to move to the city to get a master's. And at least I was in school, so it didn't feel as dangerous.
Right, you weren't getting into trouble on the daily.
Yeah, it felt like a good thing.
Any thoughts about your music directing? Does that contribute to your life as a composer? Does it take away from your life as a composer? Does it tell me? I don't know the answer.
It's both. I certainly love doing it, and because I've music directed a lot of places, I've been able to meet so many different actors and work with directors. And
so let's just clarify for everybody once again, because I just don't want to be unfair to anybody who's not already in the know. What is the job of a music director?
What is the job of a music director? Okay, well.
Buckle up, everybody.
Buckle up, everyone. We're important people. Musical starts with music. So there's this thing called a music department. I know it's crazy to people, but.
Don't get defensive. Just explain it.
I have to lead the revolution of we music directors.
We're on
who
your
have
side
no
here.
Voice.
Boy, who hurt you two? Somebody.
Everyone.
Yeah.
Everyone hurt me.
What's a music director do?
Okay. First responsibility would be to teach the music to the actor.
And people might be surprised to know a lot of actors can't read music.
Correct.
Great singers are not necessarily great musicians.
Right. That's, you know, some are great, some are not. And
right.
It's a music director's job to make sure they know what they're doing. Work with the composer to finesse any kind of other, anything music related, actually, the music director is doing. But the main job is to teach the music to the actors and then, at a certain point, get the orchestra together once the orchestrations are in, make sure the band's all sounding together, and then make sure everyone's sounding great together, along with the sound designer. And then also conduct the show, which also sometimes requires playing the piano or other instruments, and stay with it through the run of the show and actually play the show.
Yeah. I would add
it's
to
quite
that,
a big job.
Yeah. In my own experience, I would add that a music director can have a real big influence on what happens, how it turns out, you know, whether or not they advocate for the composer actively, you know, like there's a lot of power dynamics in a rehearsal room where these things get played out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think
a strong music director can have an enormous effect.
Yeah, and I find sometimes other creatives don't really speak each other's languages, so
the
director wants something to happen, but the composer doesn't know what that necessarily means dramatically or how that fits in the scope of the show and how to talk to each other, and certainly the choreographer sometimes doesn't know how to talk to the composer about what they need in terms of counts or whatever. So the music director is also helping with that, and they're also a conduit between like actor and director. If the director wants something specific, how to achieve that musically if it's a musical number, and how the composer can also help with transitions, you know, scene changes, underscore, vocal arrangement too. That's a separate job sometimes, but music director kind of does a lot of all of that.
Yeah,
it's the one creative that actually stays with the show. It's like the choreographer kind of does her thing, director does her thing, and they get to leave after opening, and the music director has to stay.
Labor.
But don't get any credit for it.
8 nights a week. Yeah. And do you think people who value your work as a music director are prepared to value your work as a composer?
No. Not yet.
We got to it.
No. I mean, just like actors who would say, like, oh, I have a play I wrote. People are a little leery, I think.
Yeah.
For some reason, you'd think it would be a little bit more natural, but for some reason they're like, but you're a music director kind of thing. So I don't know. I'm figuring, that's kind of my figuring out right now in terms of the business of how much I can use it to my advantage and then how much it's taking away. So.
But I do know that once someone establishes themselves as a talented music director, they quickly become very sought after because it's so vital.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that audiences don't usually know or see.
Absolutely.
But without whom, you know, you're lost.
Right.
Lost.
Yeah. We get no love, our music directors. So we are, I think, along with stage managers, like the unsung heroes of musicals.
But it's true. And also, as are, you know, frankly, musical theater book writers, who I often say are blamed if it's a failure and ignored if
exactly.
it's a success.
Yeah.
So, Drew, let's turn the camera on you and find out a little bit about the little boy in you. Where was he from? Where was he born?
I'm from Louisville, Kentucky.
Louisville?
Yeah.
Louisville. Oh, my goodness. Spent some good times there.
Doing what?
I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Girls got to eat, you know.
Born and raised. And so educated in Boston and lived in L.A. for a while. And then I've been in New York about 10 years. So.
Oh, my God. You just arrived, basically. 10 years.
Really? Because I feel like I've been here a very long time and I kind of want to leave.
Oh, really?
A little bit. Yeah.
Why?
I just want to. I don't know. I just came back from Key West, so of course everything sucks. But
and when did you decide to write plays and now musicals?
Well, I wrote a play when I was like 14, and it was produced in a bunch of festivals off Broadway. So I've been sort of writing plays since I was a long, young child. Yeah, I wrote a musical when I was like 15 that was published for kids. Oh yeah, I do TV. Right now, and plays and.
Wait, you're on a TV show?
No, I'm not. I'm working on a bunch of.
Oh, I see. Right, right.
TV, exciting pilots. Yeah, I mean, musicals are awesome for me, but they're very particular for my style, and I'm not a typical book writer. And
would you describe the difference between you and a typical book writer?
Well, I think that a lot of other book writers are more malleable than I am. Like, there is something very...
Oh, I can guarantee you they're more malleable than you.
There's something very specific and unrelenting I'm looking to do if it's a musical. And so I'm intense. I'm intense about it. And so it's, you know... And I'm
Is he a pain in the ass to work with?
No, I was going to say, you're actually, like... Maybe it's because I'm just so brilliantly musicalizing your ideas, Drew. But we don't really... disagree on many things. You're not like, whoa, that's not what I was thinking.
No, Jay works really well with me. Like, there's something cool about it. He rolls with me, which I really appreciate. It's a good partnership, a very platonic, great partnership that we...
But I'm willing to go that place. Like, that's the kind of stuff
he's willing to go
to
that place, and a lot of people aren't. I mean, I can't tell you, like, I have a couple other musical ideas that are a little off and off of center, and I've tried... talking to composers about them, and it doesn't land. They're too weird, I guess. And Jay doesn't do that to me, though. It's really cool. He really goes there with me. So
I'm interested in the song about the goat. Tell me a little bit about the goat song.
The goat song was really just a monologue that Peggy had that was it was probably just a speech. It was probably just a paragraph. Jay went home and just turned the monologue verbatim into a song. It was actually creatively one of the most incredible things I've ever seen, and it completely worked. I mean, there's been some reworking since. I think it is the 11 o'clock number, and it's about a goat. I mean,
it's pretty much a verbatim
for the most part.
Musicalization.
Yeah, I mean, it's evolved a little bit since then to be more of a number, but you know, there's always that song or that story about Sondheim writing Sending the Clowns in like an hour or something, or wrote it in the cab on the way home or whatever ended up happening. And I think about that with Jay, with what he did with Goat Song, where he really just made it into this incredible number.
Was the Goat Song your idea? Were you just kind of perusing the script and thinking, hey, I think this is a song? Or did you come and say...
I think it was. I was like, I think this needs to be...
I actually think that's true. I think it was your idea. Yeah.
It's like, I think it was a casual line
was
of like,
I'm,
and if I go
page.
Back to Latvia, I'll get a goat. I was like, that's definitely like a song. And I'm gonna write a song about that.
Right. Let's listen to it.
When I was 7, we went to the petting farm. It wasn't much, but it possessed a certain charm. The cuddly rabbits you could hold with just one arm. But what caught my eye the most was a goat. And now from far away, a goat seemed pretty lame. Disheveled hair and probably didn't have a name. But when I got up close, I saw we were the same. And she needed me, I needed her, that goat. She loves to climb, although she always falls back to the ground. Her jaws work overtime, consuming hay. She freely flaunts, but then she ends up getting pushed around.
I mean, it's interesting. It's such a sweet song that ultimately gets her to kill someone.
Right.
I mean, this gives her the courage to go and kill someone.
Right. That's why the juxtaposition of everything in the show is so interesting.
It also goes into Peggy's childhood, going to like petting farms and stuff in a way that I never really imagined.
But also, in terms of not knowing what those things mean, I think people recognize them when they see them or watch a show, even if they don't have the names for like 11 o'clock number or what that structure does. There's a reason why these structures have lasted for so long.
Right.
And so carefully
everybody wants
them.
To break the rules, but you do so at your peril because they're there for a reason.
Right. And I feel like when I was writing with Drew that he's breaking the rules in terms of like he's kind of writing the play that he wants to write, which is why I think it's so thrilling to write with him, because it's not like here's how a musical works. We need this song here, and then this happens, and then this happens. We're kind of just going on the journey of what he wrote, and then like figuring out where the songs might go and seeing if it works.
Do you? I'm asking you the following question, full disclosure, as a songwriter.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like I have any control over what comes out of me in the form of a song. If it comes out in 3/4 or 4/4, if it's AABA, if it's through song, who knows? Anything that comes out of me at all is a great gift from God. I'm just grateful I got. And you talk about like, well, I thought, you know, it should be structural and it should be 11 o'clock number. Like, are you pre-planning? Jay, I need you to write me a song. And it's got to be about, you know, I don't know, lost love and bagels. Like, what do you do?
Lost love and bagels. Well, I would like ponder lost love and bagels for a while. No, truly. And then I really start with music, I think. Not that we're never like a music first. So we're not like, here's the music and write lyrics on top of it kind of. But in terms of my motor, I'm always using the groove or some kind of musical hook to get me into it. And then it kind of just expands upon itself. Sometimes I'll get at the same time lyric and music, and that'll become the hook. And then I just kind of expand around it. And then if I find okay, this needs to be a certain structure, then I'll kind of put that on top of it. But whatever comes out first is what comes out first.
And does it come out first through your fingers on the keyboard?
I try to not write a lot at the piano initially, because I was a classical pianist growing up. So I think I go to, as we all do, I think certain chords and certain things that we just doodle on the piano with automatically.
Right. So what do? You hum something to yourself?
Yeah, I try to like live in the words. If I do have any words to hang on to, and to see how that would be most naturally sung until it's something that forms in my head. And then around that, I can kind of create the vocabulary around that hook, I guess. But it's not necessarily always the hook of the song. It could be the bridge of the song or just a musical idea.
Right. Do you ever get blocked?
Yeah, of course. Of course. I just need time away from it then.
Mm-hmm.
If I do have an idea of a structure, then maybe I'll listen to something that will help me. Like Velna's song, for example, is clearly a Rachmaninoff ripoff. I mean, it's just his very famous piano piece in G minor. And she's not even Russian. She's Latvian.
Latvian.
But the whole point, I think, to me, that's funny. Like, it's a musical joke. Like, she's so broad that I'm using this Russian
right,
very famous piano piece.
Why don't we listen to a little bit of sure. that so we can hear the Rachmaninoff that you ripped off.
Perfect cup.
Time goes tick, tick, coffee drip, drip. I begin to wonder when is my turn. Time is ticking.
So, bum, do, 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 dum, do, do. Dude, that whole, that's just Rachmaninoff.
Right, but that's just a basic sort of Hungarian, Russian figure.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he was nationalistic too, right? So Rachmaninoff was writing in that kind of way. So she's very nationalistic. So
it's like saying I took a walking blues bass line and ripped it off. You didn't rip it off. It's just one of the like five basic
I mean,
figures.
I ripped it off. I mean, it's the same key. It's the same rhythm. And then I riffed off of it after that.
I see.
Into like a more Hungarian thing after in this part. But Drew probably has no idea that I'm just ripping off all these classical composers all the time.
I figured you were ripping off someone, but yeah.
Great, thanks.
Well, classical composers ripped each other off all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I think I'm such a classical like based person in terms of my like training.
Yeah.
I'm always starting there.
Well, that's an enormous advantage, I would think.
Oh yeah.
In the world of musical theater composing, to have all of those ideas at your fingertips, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's why people think I don't sound like other contemporary writers, because I'm not writing. I'm kind of digging into a different pool.
Yeah, I have to agree. I have to agree. It didn't sound like that usual, like, bump, 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 bump. Here's the opening song.
Going to Starbucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because so many contemporary songs are just like listing what I'm doing today.
Well, composers have a lot of power over people's feelings. It's remarkable how much a great composer can whipsaw an audience through, you know, a series of changing emotions very quickly, mm-hmm. very powerfully, and one hopes very effectively.
Right.
And we are going to close this very delightful, entertaining, and I think enlightening conversation with the title song.
So the title song is right after Peggy has just bludgeoned Velna to death with a frozen baked potato.
No turning back, Peggy.
It is the victory song.
Old days are over, you found your four-leaf clover,
and what you see in front of you is...
Well, in this mirror here, my hair does look a little more bouncy.
With my amazing musicians, by the way, Izo Hassman, cellist, and Justin Vance, who's on reeds. Amazing musicians.
Sounds terrific. You arranged it?
I did. It's my first really orchestration I've ever tried to do.
Have a moment just with you.
Uh-huh.
Don't you look spick and span and 10 times as shiny?
I do. I do.
It's time at last. What's past is past. The old Peggy was the pest in everybody's gardens.
The old Peggy was a vomit bag for all.
The old Peggy said too many sorries and pardons.
The old Peggy was that nasty bathroom stall.
Looking back at all the years, there's so much time I wasted.
So full of hope, I think. This is like,
yeah.
I'm always trying to play against Drew's sickness here, but hopeful music. But it's always like the playing the positive choice thing.
But this is the musical theater, happy, fantastical world that she's in.
We're about to go to that musical theater world. And like,
can feel it now.
About one measure. Here we go.
The new Peggy.
She turns heads on Main Street.
The new Peggy.
She could wear a thong.
The new Peggy. She can do a cartwheel.
Look at her go.
She can do no wrong. The new Peggy.
Don't take crap from nobody.
The new Peggy.
Could run for a county clerk.
The new Peggy. Knows the Heimlich.
And the breaststroke.
And she can drop it like it's hot. And bend and snap and twerk.
if anybody tries to boss her.
They'll be made aware of the new sheriff in town.
If anybody tries to cross her.
Peggy's stepping up, so you better step down.
She reads Shakespeare and Chaucer.
And speaks Mandarin and Greek.
Ni hao.
And look out for her centerfold in Playboy next week.
The new Peggy.
Can mountain climb while making dinner.
The new Peggy.
Can have sex in a swing.
The new Peggy
likes to belt out pirate songs
and pierces her vagina with a matching eyebrow ring.
When I got here in the morning, it was just another Monday. Still invisible, a failure, flop, a dud. Little did I know it would become a get it done day. All because of my prepackaged frozen spud. If you see me on the street and do not recognize me, I'll remind you that it's me, the revamped 2.0. The old Peggy now is new, embrace and idolize me. Harry's jaw is gonna drop and he'll say, whoa.
The new Peggy
does body shots and neon lighting.
The new Peggy
can perm and highlight her own hair.
The new Peggy
does downward dog
while eating Pop-Tarts.
And she can spit out fire, walk on water, fly through air. Yeah, Harry's finally gonna notice after all the years I've tried. I'm blossoming into a lotus. No longer will I be denied. I'll say good morning, Harry, and bring him his cup. The new Peggy will be his to digest and soak up.
The new Peggy
makes her presence known when she walks through doorways.
The new Peggy
drinks cosmos on the beach.
Well, as we listen to the final strains of the title song, allow me to say thank you, gentlemen, so much.
Thank you.
For joining me here on the Micro Musical Theater Show.
It's been a pleasure. It has. I've had fun with you. You may not have had fun with me, but I've had fun with you.
All right. I'll take your word for it. Usually I can tell when someone's had fun with me. But best of luck, gentlemen. I look forward to hearing the story of the new Peggy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are new.
Oh, ta-la-la-sha. I feel so alive.
Call me, that's where you'll end it.
Yes, that's
right. I feel so alive.
Oh, ta-la-la-sha. That's great.
And...
the new Peggy.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's catchy, fucker.